Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I think we've all been in neighborhoods that we feel are vibrant, thriving. Maybe it's kids on bikes or people on the sidewalk. Or if it's an urban neighborhood, maybe it's diverse businesses mixed in with housing. You can see people shopping, working, playing. We've also all been to neighborhoods that feel dead, even if they're filled with fancy houses. So how do you build or foster a vibrant neighborhood, a diverse neighborhood? I got the opportunity to pose these questions to a panel of experts at the Iowa Ideas Conference organized by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It took place in Cedar Rapids last week, and the guests on my panel were Chuck Connerly, professor and director, School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa, Nancy Bird, executive director of the Iowa City Downtown District, Stephanie Prusch, executive director of Neighborhood Finance Corporation, and Chris Nosbisch, city administrator of the City of Mount Vernon. And so I want to start with that question of what makes a vibrant neighborhood. And I know that you all have a lot of opinions about that. And Chuck, I'm going to let you start with the elements that you feel come together to make a vibrant neighborhood.
Good morning, everybody. I'm glad to be able to go first because I will steal everybody's thunder. Because everybody knows the answer to this question, at least if they're trained in urban planning. The answer is Jane Jacobs. Author of, you knew I was going to say this, The Death and Life of American Cities. How she defined vibrancy was basically based on people and the environments in which people could thrive. So this meant a mix of land uses. This meant that people could not only live in a place but also shop in a place and work nearby. This meant eyes on the street. Allow people to surveil their own neighborhoods. It meant density. She was a New Yorker. She lived in Greenwich Village, and she believed in the value of density. Those are all ingredients, mixed-use density, that old buildings, a mix of old and new buildings. Those are a mix that work in a variety of different places. Where people don't feel comfortable, where there's no place to walk, where there's no place to go, where they stay inside their homes. Typically, a neighborhood lacks vibrancy. The only time those people will come out to an event is when they feel like something is threatening, and they become what's called a defendable neighborhood. But we need neighborhoods to be more than just defendable enclaves. They need to be places where people are actively involved in the community. And Jane Jacobs' notion of a walkable, livable neighborhood is sort of, among urban planners, is gospel. She wrote the book in 1961, and it's still the most important book ever written in U.S. planning. So that's my answer. Now I've stole everybody's thunder.
I'll bet they have a few things to add. And I mean, Nancy, let's focus on, because of your expertise with the Iowa City Downtown District, let's focus on an urban neighborhood. What do you feel can make an urban neighborhood thrive?
Well, I want to, everything that Chuck said was really on point. The design of the neighborhood is really important, and some neighborhoods were designed well or even protected. Like in the case of the Iowa City Downtown District, one of the unique features of it is that the blocks, the fine-grained blocks are still there. There are other parts of the community where the block structure became bigger and bigger, or cul-de-sacs, which create different types of environments. So in some sense, you know, downtown Iowa City has got a really great head start on that piece of it. It's anchored with clearly a major institution, and it has kept its vibrancy because the economy and other things work there. Having said that, I had an interesting question posed to me from someone running for city council, and they said, who has jurisdiction over a vibrant neighborhood? And it was a good question, because the reality is not all neighborhoods are designed that way. And in the neighborhoods that aren't designed that way, number one, city planners have some work to do to try and correct for things that aren't natural, that don't create healthy settings for people to walk and move around naturally. But at the same time, there is a huge role of the people who live there and the people that have businesses there And if they are united in voice, there is so much work you can do. In my past role, I worked in Seattle for 15 years helping to set up improvement districts. And each one was started by people in neighborhoods that were completely diverse, very different settings. They all had different issues. And it was really the leadership and the community there that said, you know what, we have something here to celebrate, and we need to work on some things. So where that leadership and that community activism comes to play, you can improve and get to a place where everyone in the neighborhood can be proud of. And that's, I think, my goal for, I really believe in neighborhoods. I think they're the foundational elements of cities and states and nations. And it starts there, but to empower people to really make progress in their own setting, it's very possible. And I hope that that's one of the takeaways from today.
Now, okay, thinking about an urban neighborhood in your case, Chris, in Mount Vernon, I mean, it's a city of a little over 4,000 people, and it's a lovely town, and a lot of people probably are thinking about moving there. So you have the opportunity to grow and build these subdivisions like we see in towns all over Iowa. So how do you grow and foster vibrant neighborhoods as that expansion happens? I know that's something you've focused a lot on in Mount Vernon.
I think first and foremost is cities, especially in Iowa, we tend to be...
Nice and close with the mic.
We tend to be on the backside when it comes to urban planning, regulation. The role that Mount Vernon has taken, and I think why we're so successful, we treat our city, first of all, as one large neighborhood. So we don't have gated communities. We do have historic districts. We have a number of walkable areas. We have Cornell. They all are inclusive. They're not gated by any means. One of the issues that I have seen in my travels as of late is cities rush to control things they feel like they should be controlling, only to turn around and create more problems. So, for instance, subdivision guidelines, when they are not a partner with and more take on kind of a more adversarial role, typically what you have is subdivisions that are far outside the range of the middle class, lower class. We are doing that in effect by placing more regulations on these and not being a partner. So what Mount Vernon has done, to the tune of almost $2 million with both developers that have subdivisions that are going in right now, has partnered with them. We are offering tax incentives to create traditional neighborhoods. We were able to convince two developers to give up almost 25 acres of ground for green space, stormwater management, walkable trails, and begrudgingly, you know, they did it, but there's an incentive, obviously, for them to make that happen. And I think that's going to be more important moving forward as the cities and governing bodies become partners with developers and not adversaries.
All right, so being more proactive, more involved as those neighborhoods grow.
Absolutely.
Stephanie, coming at this from the finance angle, tell me what makes a vibrant neighborhood from your perspective.
Yeah, this is a very interesting discussion. I agree with what everybody said here. You know, spending most of my career working in neighborhoods and on the capital side, except for a break working during the foreclosure crisis where I worked on that, I would say access to capital that allows people to earn equity in their homes is huge. Because we've seen, I've spent most of my career in Des Moines, and we've seen what's happened to our older neighborhoods where people got loans that didn't allow them to build equity, and then when they got in trouble, those homes ended up in foreclosure. And it really decimated neighborhoods near our urban core that were doing great. So I would just say, you know, that's one piece that people don't often think about, but the kind of loans that people have that are living in your neighborhoods impact your value as well as their ability to stay in their home long term.
Well, and we see a trend going on right now where young people are a little less interested in becoming homeowners and also maybe not able to become homeowners. Do you feel like that negatively impacts our neighborhoods?
I don't think that home ownership is key. I mean, great, there are great rentals in neighborhoods and multifamily, you know, condos, townhomes that can be mixed. It's how those are managed. And so what we've seen, and probably if you're working in urban neighborhoods, you've seen as well, is a lot of those homes that were owner-occupied and were foreclosed on were picked up by people that maybe don't have the best interest of the neighborhood at heart and are using those houses as basically like a cash cow. You know, they're not interested in being a strong landlord that's investing in the neighborhood. And so that's where the problem. I think homeownership's great for people that are ready for homeownership, but really you just want people that in the neighborhood that are interested in investing in the neighborhood.
We also have a long tradition in this country of discrimination in lending, and that affects the ability of many people to get into a house, doesn't it?
I think it has, and it's really, if you haven't read anything about what's going on, like Undesigning the Red Line, we had an exhibit in Des Moines, and I know it's traveling nationally. It's really interesting to see how those historical patterns impacted neighborhoods even today. Obviously, I work for a lender. We lend to a very diverse clientele, so I can only speak to our experience that we... You know, that's not our model, but I don't think that, but I suspect that discrimination still does occur, and I hear that from folks that I work with throughout the nation.
I mean, we had a fairly high-profile story about one local bank, maybe was it 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and their discrimination against Latino individuals who were seeking loans. So, I mean, I'm sure it's something that is continuing to happen in Iowa and around the country.
Yeah. So, can I just put in one more plug? Yeah. We administer some down payment money that we got federally, and down payment money is huge. Is an ability to get raise the homeownership rate for African American and Hispanic families. We served about 50% of the households that we served with those funds were minority borrowers, which is huge when you look at home ownership rates in Iowa for especially African Americans. We're one of the worst in the nation. So plug for down payment money wherever we can get it. It really does make a difference and moves the needle on home ownership.
We're listening to a conversation about how to foster vibrant neighborhoods recorded at the 2019 Iowa Ideas Conference in Cedar Rapids. More after a break. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Some neighborhoods are lively, welcoming, and vibrant. Others... not so much. This hour, we're talking about how to foster vibrant, diverse neighborhoods. This conversation was recorded at the 2019 Iowa Ideas Conference, organized by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. The panelists are Chuck Connerly, Professor and Director, School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa, Nancy Bird, Executive Director with the Iowa City Downtown District, Stephanie Prusch, Executive Director of Neighborhood Finance Corporation, and Chris Nosbisch, City Administrator with the City of Mount Vernon.
Chuck, everybody who's been talking about vibrant neighborhoods has really mentioned a diversity of, at least socioeconomic diversity, bringing vibrancy to the neighborhoods. And as Chris was pointing out, where we see a lot of towns and cities growing is the opposite of that, where we see, you know, all of the houses in the neighborhood look the same, all of the houses in the neighborhood cost about the same, and, you know, come with the same kinds of perks. So what is the downside of those subdivisions that we see everywhere?
It's huge. The concept, it seems to be uniquely American, of detached single-family homes that are owner-occupied. And this tradition goes back well into the middle of the 19th century. But unlike in Europe, when they adopted zoning, they didn't exclude residential from other types of activities, particularly commercial. We did that, and then we have all these neighborhoods that are exclusively single-family detached neighborhoods. And people want homogeneity, in part because the major, if not the major, investment in their life, their security, especially when, you know, we don't have this, you know, all of us who have 401ks and saw what happened in the stock market yesterday, we don't have the security that we once did of a defined benefit plan, a defined benefit pension plan. So our house is what we're really counting on. And then we're worried about anything that might affect the value of that home. That produces a very anti-social, anti-diversity type of attitude. And so we hear stories all the time about people fighting the idea of having an apartment building in their neighborhood, of having anything that would smack of lower income housing or even middle income housing. And so this has an impact not only on the diversity of our neighborhoods, it has an impact on our ability to deal with climate change. Because if you have to drive everywhere, obviously that increases the amount of greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere. I feel very conflicted. I really feel strongly about the idea of neighborhood empowerment, especially when neighborhoods have been discriminated against. But on the other hand, there is a public interest out there that I think should be served as well, and that public interest relates to diversity and social justice.
Well, and it's interesting that what we seem to think we want, those single-family homes on the large lots in the subdivisions with the big lawns, doesn't necessarily correlate to happiness in where we live. And, I mean, Nancy, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, because people, you know, tend to start in more urban centers in their young professional lives as they, you know, rent an apartment, and then they succeed. And they move out. And then a lot of research has shown us that they don't like it as much.
Right. We see that everywhere, actually. And the reality is that in our current region, we see all kinds of different types of housing and all different kinds of, like, commercial nodes. And the value, I always think that this is kind of, it's a matter of supply and demand. And when communities work really hard to make an area nice, it increases the demand for that area, which is sort of it's a conundrum of sorts. But we see, I mean, I can think of staff in our own office who really would love to live closer into work, and where they've ended up purchasing their first home has been a ways away. But they are thinking about public transportation, they're thinking about ways to get in, and oftentimes I think almost it's a matter of better informing our development community what the demand is there. Because we have a certain palette of housing currently, and it's very easy to just keep chunking out those homes for developers. But the more they start to evolve their practice and change their format, and the city is a partner to that, then I think that we can introduce new forms of housing that aren't there currently. I'm hear all the time that people really want to live in mixed income neighborhoods. And we don't have a lot of that type of development out there. And it takes a certain skill set on the developer's side, a certain level of risk, because maybe it's not here in our current market, but the demand is there. So the more we can help inform that conversation and come together, and I think that really, going back to the idea of, like, it's not all about city government. It comes down to neighborhood champions. And those champions are out there, and how can we empower them? Everyday citizens, cultural entities, whoever they are, they can really make an impact in that conversation. And it takes someone to kind of, like, you know, ring the bell for it before those conversations can really get move forward. So I think there's an opportunity for everybody to learn, especially when a lot of people are growing up in the suburbs. So that is something that they're familiar with. They're familiar with how to drive into your garage, and the garage goes down, and you go inside. You don't really talk to your neighbors much. You're ordering everything online. It's very convenient. It's ordered to your door. They're not seeing some of the conflicts out there that, as a society, I think we need to confront and work on. When you're in closer quarters to your neighbors, and when you're, you know, you actually know the store owner, and you see how these little things that you do every day make a big difference in the lives of your neighbors, I think that's where there's room for growth and learning. And I think we just need to all be patient and yet still push that conversation.
So, Chris, in Mount Vernon, when you're communicating with developers, I mean, a lot of developers have a way of doing business, and they like to do it the way they've been doing it, where, you know, okay, I'm going to buy all of these lots, and I know what kinds of houses I want to put up, and maybe I even know what color I want those houses to be, because this is a certain look that I'm looking for. When you are engaging with developers, how receptive are they? Have you had developers just say, you know what, maybe this town is not where we want to build?
Well, that's a loaded question. So I will say this, and I don't know how many of you have been in Mount Vernon, but I have a luxury in Mount Vernon versus any other community that I've been in the entire state of Iowa. My luxury is that I have a council and a planning commission that does not care if you do not want to play by our rules. If you do not want to play by our rules, we don't need you. We haven't built a subdivision. We've had one subdivision in 10 years before the other two opened up. So part of it is kind of having the intestinal fortitude of the governing body to say, no, you're fine. The other is kind of regulating with an open mind. I will tell you that both of the developers that we have operating right now are doing some of those, what I would consider Iowa traditional type style subdivisions, but what we're getting in the back end is almost $750,000 worth of low to moderate income funding that's going to serve our mixed use development that now stands between existing Highway 30 and the new Highway 30 bypass. So we're giving some in the end. The developers are definitely giving some on the backside. But I would say that it does boil down to, the worst part about Iowa right now is we hear this all the time about small communities desperate for new housing, desperate for new value. We're property tax laden at a government level, so we rely on new development and new monies coming in order to fund operations. And so as long as that system stays in place, it will be difficult for, you know, 75 to 80% of the communities in Iowa to have the same mindset that we do.
And thinking about people buying older homes, and you know, because we've all seen neighborhoods decline over time, where the homes get older, look older, get cheaper, or get purchased as rental properties, and then continue sort of a downward slide. I mean, Chuck, do you want to jump in?
I don't know if I have a comment so much as a question. In the work that we've done in urban planning in connection with the Iowa Initiative for Sustainable Communities in small towns is, you know, this what Chris is saying, that there is no new housing, but we're trying to attract teachers, we're trying to retain teachers, we're trying to attract other people who could add to the vitality of this community. But they don't like the housing that we have, and there's new housing going up. And so the question is, can your program be used to help revitalize small towns by giving people an opportunity, a school teacher, to buy an older home? And then there's always the issue, who's currently living in the older home? Because we know we have many aging people, aged people, people my age in these communities, and maybe they're overly housed. Maybe there should be an alternative for them. So, is there a way of sort of recycling those homes so that your typical school teacher could afford them and they could become available?
Well, I think that's what we do. I mean, a lot of the homes. In fact, the first house that we had that was marketed with our program in Cedar Rapids was a home where the woman had moved to assisted living. Her family was selling the house. They didn't want to do all the repairs to make it attractive to a current home buyer. You know, it still had the pink bathroom and all of those sorts of things. And so they marketed it with our house, and it was one of the first purchase loans we did. So it was exactly that story. And you know, that's what we're there for. But we're one piece of the puzzle. You know, there's we go into neighborhoods. The idea is that it's a neighborhood planning process. And it was touched on, I can't speak to the power of neighborhood leaders to making it happen, because those are the neighborhoods where we're the most effective, is where there's strong neighborhood leadership. And it's been very exciting to see in the past few years in Des Moines, we've been able to take some groups to leadership summits and to see those neighborhoods sort of pass the baton to the younger folks that are moving into the neighborhood and the things that they're doing. On Facebook, one of the people just announced that he's opening a coffee shop in his neighborhood. You know, they're opening small businesses, they're leading change, they're bringing public art, et cetera.
Well, a lot of you have mentioned leadership in the neighborhood, the champions, that kind of thing. Now, and also, everybody is busy. Nobody wants to join another group. Nobody wants to go to another set of meetings. Nobody wants to be the person to say, you know, to start something and try to get it moving, because that's a lot of time and energy in addition to all of the other things that you're giving your time and energy to. But what do we know about neighborhood, and I'm going to use the term association, although they're not all neighborhood associations. What do we know about neighborhood associations that work? What actually works in organizing a neighborhood and this leadership? Chuck, you want to start?
Well, yes, and the emergence of leadership is really difficult. I mean, I won't tell an old joke that about economists, but basically say, first we assume we have a leader, and then it's all easy after that. But we can't assume that. I think one model, certainly that is in Iowa City, is the Center for Worker Justice, which is an advocacy organization that has worked on a number of issues, but worked in several mobile home parks with both Sudanese and Latino residents in those areas, knocking on doors, talking to people, basically practicing old-fashioned community organizing. But, you know, because they have paid staff, as well as one of my former master's students, excuse me, who was not paid, knocking on people's doors, that there is the leadership that it shouldn't run the organization, the residents should run it. But at least with that outside catalyst, somebody saying, these are things you can do. There are ways in which, that you can make, you know, take a petition, maybe not a literal petition, but to city council to deal with the developer, even if it's an external developer. You don't just have to take this or just complain about it. You can do something about it. So that kind of assistance, and I'm primarily familiar with the Center for Worker Justice, but those types of advocacy organizations that we should be supporting, I think, are instrumental in addressing that.
Nancy, you had something you wanted to say.
Well, the City of Iowa City has a part-time neighborhood position to support neighborhood associations. So associations are built all over the city. The city has put out a nod to, like, hey, we'll help you get structured. Let's have some meetings. Here are some community tools. But the volunteer status of the neighborhood associations is, like, one of the challenges. But, you know, where at least it's an opportunity to jump in and say, hey, I see that there's an avenue here. I can get some information. It's a good start. But getting that paid champion is really, that's helpful.
Well, all right, this is Iowa Ideas. We're supposed to be thinking big. And from my perspective, you know, Iowa has 3.1 million people. We've grown more slowly than many other states. As we see our communities expand, I can see us, and I'm sure others can as well, see us copying the patterns of growth from cities around the country, making a lot of the same mistakes that people have already made in other places as we grow and sprawl. So what can we learn from the rest of the country? What can we do different here if you guys have the control to get us to grow in a different way? What would you change? Chuck?
That is a big questions generate, hopefully big ideas, we'll see. I think one of the things that Iowa has to face up to, when you mentioned that the state is slow growing, in the 20th century, it was the slowest growing state in the nation. And I don't know what it's, you know, and we haven't improved much since 2000. Basically, we were built out in 1900. Many counties reached their peak population in 1900. Okay, so where is the population growth now? Very few whites move to Iowa. The net migration of whites to Iowa is, population growth of whites is very small. It's African Americans, it's Hispanics, and it's Asian Americans primarily. Those are the big spikes in growth. Iowa, which was until 1970, Iowa was 99% white and was that way for a long time. It's still the fifth widest state in the nation. We, as a state, need to embrace diversity. If we want to grow, and obviously how we grow is important in that as well, but I think part of how we grow is defining ourselves or redefining ourselves as a diverse state. And I think that is a big challenge of the 21st century.
We're listening to a conversation about how to foster vibrant neighborhoods, recorded at the 2019 Iowa Ideas Conference in Cedar Rapids. The panelists are Chuck Connerly, professor and director of the School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa, Nancy Bird, executive director with the Iowa City Downtown District, Stephanie Prusch, executive director of Neighborhood Finance Corporation, and Chris Nosbisch, city administrator with the City of Mount Vernon. More after a break. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how to foster vibrant, diverse neighborhoods. This conversation was recorded at the 2019 Iowa Ideas Conference organized by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. The panelists are Chuck Connerly, professor and director of the School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa, Nancy Bird, executive director with the Iowa City Downtown District, Stephanie Prusch, executive director with Neighborhood Finance Corporation, and Chris Nosbisch, city administrator with the City of Mount Vernon. And before the break, I asked, given that Iowa is a slower growing state, what can we learn about healthy growth from the mistakes that have been made and the lessons learned in other parts of the country? Nancy Bird's response is up next.
All right.
It is a hard question. One of the things that I can remember, I moved here 7 years ago, and when I was in Seattle, and I was there, I was thinking about my own hometown because some of the properties there, some of the just lovely neighborhoods in my own hometown were similar to some of the ones in Seattle that went for millions of dollars. And I kept thinking, like, what is the big difference? I know this location and there's density and things like that, but I think there's a cultural element here that we need to, as a state, do a lot more learning and be open to the learning. Because, you know, culture can eat strategy for lunch. We can devise a great plan, but if the culture isn't there and ready for it, you know, it's just really challenging to push it forward. So in my mind, when I think about my own, I grew up in Washington, Iowa, which is 7,000 people 20 years ago. It's still 7,000 people. It's an amazing town. And I think a lot of it has to do with confidence and understanding of the assets that we have as a state. Because I think if we were all to do that in ways that are big and small, there can be change here.
Well, so I have a different perspective. I work in two urban areas, the two largest in Iowa, which, you know, globally aren't that big, but for us they are. And, you know, both have come out with housing studies in the past year, and right now I'm better at memorizing the Des Moines ones, but both are, I think it's 120,000 when you combine the two metros that were short on housing that's affordable to the folks that are moving to our communities. So even though our state's not growing, we have a serious housing shortage. And I live in Des Moines, and I don't know who here is from Des Moines and has been part of the conversations that have been going on around our new zoning that will be passing in October, but it's been very interesting to both have this housing study that says today we're 53,000 units short of housing, yet the housing that will be developed, we also develop single-family homes in Des Moines, and though we do it now mostly without subsidy in the neighborhoods that we serve, we will now need $20,000 to $30,000 worth of subsidy to build a home, an infill home. And where's that money going to come from? You know, so we only do 10 to 12 houses a year, and now we're maybe going to be able to do 3 or 4. So, you know, it's just interesting to think. And I don't have the answers to it. I understand why Des Moines is doing what they're doing. It's more they're trying to look at the fair share of the metro and increase their property taxes. So, you know, that's the motivation behind it, and that it's that it's up to the whole community to house the folks that are working in our community. Chris?
So I have two things. First, I'm going to start, and I can say this because I grew up in Waterloo, but the case study in Iowa to me is the city of Waterloo and the city of Dubuque. And for those that lived it in the 80s, both communities were at the brink of the last person shut the lights off, John Deere is gone.
We had bumper stickers, yeah. I remember.
So, but if you drive by them or drive through them today, you'll see stark differences. Dubuque is about 20 years ahead of where Waterloo should be and had half the resources. And again, it was culture, leadership, and all of that, but they offered some programs, they did some things, they diversified their workforce. They looked at this problem and go, basically to everybody in town, how are we going to fix it? And they started 20 years ago, Waterloo started 5. And, you know, I've been invited back there, and I would say the same thing. You know, and I've read the articles on Des Moines, too, but it's the same thing that everybody else has done. How many of your cities offer incentives to new housing? So you get a tax abatement if you buy a new house. Just about every in the metro. And I worked 5 years there, too. How many of your cities will offer down payment assistance to new homebuyers? And I would say that you can have traditional neighborhoods or neighborhoods that the developers want to develop today if the cities would get on board and fulfill some of the funding on the backside. The problem is it's easier for us to say, we'll give you a tax abatement because it doesn't cost us anything. We have to try and figure out how to go out and fund down payment assistance. So that's what we're doing. We're taking the $500,000 to $750,000 we're going to get in revenue from these two housing subdivisions and create our own program. We don't qualify for federal or state funding. We're well-to-do in the grand scheme of things. But again, we're going to borrow from things that are working and go ahead and start them ourselves. So taking risk, recognizing there's issues, I think is a huge thing. But the answers are all there. It's just having the drive to want to go ahead and push people to do it.
And where does that drive come from?
It can start small. It's the culture of the community. It is top to bottom, people actually doing what they say.
So it's I'm hearing a lot of the same things from everybody, and so many of our personal decisions with housing are just that, very personal. People tend to have kind of a tunnel vision about what I want, and I'm not so concerned about what other people need and want when I make those personal decisions. Chuck, returning to embracing diversity in the state, we have seen some small communities in Iowa do a fantastic job embracing diversity. Small towns that would have died without an influx of immigrants coming in to do jobs that nobody locally wanted to do.
Columbus Junction,
for example. We've also seen other towns where it hasn't It hasn't worked. And, not that it hasn't worked. The people are there. They're doing the jobs. They're living there. But the town hasn't come together. There hasn't been that embrace. And it's not a great place to live. So what can each one of us in this room, and what can we say to our friends and neighbors, what can we do to change this culture as we move forward? Chuck?
Oh, God. Great question, yeah. Iowa faces real challenges in the 21st century. Obviously, with climate change, we don't know what's going to happen to the farm economy. As I said earlier, our growth is a diverse growth, and we need to learn how to embrace it. The thing that I was thinking of in the conversation that affects a lot of communities is childcare, I'm stealing this from the previous panel. I'm sorry, I apologize for everybody, but it's what we hear in community after community when we go into communities that don't have the good fortune of that Mount Vernon has. They're trying to attract teachers, etc., retain them. The issue comes up over and over again of childcare or the lack of childcare. This is at a crisis level in the state of Iowa, and And it's related to the fact that most families have two income earners. They can't. There needs to be a recognition of that. There really needs to be a state childcare policy program and initiative that tries to address this. This is vital to all these communities that are losing population or simply not growing.
All right, empower us, Nancy.
Well, I'm not sure if this will meet the measure, but the one thing that I would say is that, you know, that question about what can we all do, oftentimes in these communities, in any community, quite frankly, the leadership element is so important. You're not always going to have a great set of cards, so to speak, with leaders. And I think where communities can come together and just say, hey, where do we have consensus here? Let's start small on our consensus items and empower people to say yes. I mean, I think that leadership element of saying, you know, if someone comes in, we're not going to say no, we're going to say yes. And if you can do those things and wait for timing, because honestly, sometimes you have some bad chemistry in a community or in whatever thing you're trying to do. So if it's timing, you can kind of wait for the timing, but work on the small things to get to know one another, build relationships. I think those things over the course of time make a big difference. I know that when I first started the downtown district, I actually got, my friends were like, what are you doing? This community is known for being split apart. You're working for a board. You're gonna be the first one to go when this doesn't work. But we started small with things that everyone could agree upon. And once people built those relationships and understand the intentions of others that you may be polar opposites with on the way they perform or what they believe in, you build coalitions, and then that starts to carry on into the next thing. And we've been successful doing that. I would say in the Iowa City community, we have a wonderful city manager with Jeff Fruin, our economic development leadership with Mark Nolte and Josh Hamburger and Kim Casco. Our connection with the University of Iowa has only gotten stronger with those just meeting and recognizing it's not all going to work this time, but what can we work on together that can? And over the course of time, it can make a difference on those things that are harder.
Stephanie?
I feel like I'm repeating, but leadership, you know, when I look at things that have happened, I mean, the fact that neighborhood finance was brought here, it was because the city leadership and neighborhood leaders said, we had great progress during the floods, you know, and we want to continue that. And it was that power. It wasn't me. It was me sort of in the background saying, well, this is how we're set up, and then them making it happen. So it was leadership, but I think with, you know, as I look at what's happening in Des Moines, it's, again, I'm going to say leadership with an equity lens. Because if it's leadership out of fear, it doesn't work.
It was worth repeating.
Okay.
And Chris?
I actually think Nancy said it the best, and I'll just simplify my answer in that get a win. We can all sit down and identify problems, and typically we identify this large picture. We'll spend 15 to 20 years studying that large picture. By the time that we print or come up with whatever plan of attack that we have, the problem has shifted to another problem. Start small. Get wins. Get buy-in. I would say that, we, you know, as funny as it is, we have 12 different festivals in Mount Vernon, and they're as diversified as they can. They all started by a conversation probably on the way to coffee in the morning as we should try this. So we did. And some won, some lost, but we didn't stop trying to get those little wins. And then eventually we would get the big ones. And for us, the community wellness center that we're under construction right now, we've been talking about that for 20 years. But we've done a lot of things in between those 20 years. So we did a lot of little things that have helped get us to where we're at, and we finally got the big one. Put a list together and knock off as many as you can, as quickly as you can, and then people will start seeing that you're actually do intend to move forward with everything that you're planning to do, and you'll start to knock off some of the bigger projects.
If I could add one more item. Are we out of time? Is that what I was going to say? The basic concept of the small town in Iowa, that is a downtown with residential areas that you, from which you could walk to downtown, is a fantastic concept. And even though in some ways it is a 19th century concept, it has strong appeal for the 21st century as an alternative to the kind of urban life that I used to love. I used to love Chicago. I still love Chicago, but I'd rather live in Iowa. So we have a lot going for us. And so we should continue to see our communities as being assets rather than liabilities.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left. I see they put the question screen up. So if you do have a question that you want to send to us, or you could just shout it out and I can repeat it, because that might be faster. Sure.
Me?
Yeah.
A couple. One is for Chris. I'm fascinated by your can't say no. I lived in Houston at one point for a year, and Houston is a town built by people who couldn't say no. Second question involves this word affordable, which I've never been very fond of. Why do we use this word affordable, and why are we not willing to address the real needs of those who don't happen to be earning $60,000 a year?
So I'll go back to my no question. We do eventually get to know on some items, but my staff isn't allowed to say no initially. Typically because I've worked in communities where the initial answer is no, and case in point would be the large ag manufacturer just by Williamsburg. Somebody said no. If you follow the history, somebody told them no, somebody told them yes, and now look at that entire area. That was a small business that started in a garage. So that's why I don't allow them initially to say no. But here's the trick when you talk about affordable, and this is the biggest issue that I have seen. We have a housing commission in Mount Vernon, and for the last 2 years, we've tried to define affordable housing. We still don't have a definition, because everybody's definition is different. Going back to trying to create small wins, that's what we've done, is we've started to outline little things that we can do to get us to that affordable housing situation. But again, I made the comment earlier, as long as Iowa cities are tied to property tax and the state controls all of those rules, you're going to see those high-rise situations where there's a million-dollar penthouse because they need that to operate on an annual basis.
Well, we have run out of time, but I do want to say thank you to all of you for being so thoughtful and for coming today. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to a conversation about how to foster vibrant neighborhoods recorded at the 2019 Iowa Ideas Conference in Cedar Rapids. The panelists are Chuck Connerly, Professor and Director of School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa, Nancy Bird, Executive Director with the Iowa City Downtown District, Stephanie Prusch, Executive Director of Neighborhood Finance Corporation, and Chris Nosbisch, City Administrator with the City of Mount Vernon. Thank you very much to the Cedar Rapids Gazette for the opportunity. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.